In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. It's clear to many the shutdowns are way beyond the COVID-19 virus. If you've done a little digging on the internet, such as typing in PCR test 90% inaccurate, and you're honest with yourself, you'll see why people are resisting. If you're on a steady diet of corporate-owned news, then any challenge to their narrative would likely be perceived as conspiracy. You think this is about President Trump. President Trump said, in reality, they're not after me, they're after you. I'm just in the way. It's clear we're under assault and fooled by a formula of manipulation and the inverted truth. Many ask, how would or could such an inaccurate test be used to determine a COVID-19 infection? That can't be. There are tens of thousands of people in positions of authority that would prevent leaders from making decisions to shut down economies based on flawed data. But as we've heard from past guests, attorneys Tom Rents and David Helm, and many other sources, the governor administrations of Ohio and Michigan blocked lawyers from accessing their emails and public information, such as state-level test data and infection statistics. Many doctors have come forward explaining how the RT-PCR test that Kerry Mullis created was not designed to test for infection. Yet this is how states across this country have determined infection within their populace. Let's hear from Dr. Tom Cowan, another doctor reminding us about the inaccuracy of the PCR test.
The test is called a RT-PCR test. It's otherwise known as a viral load test. And the test is a surrogate test. It was developed and by a guy named Kerry Mullis, who was given the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for essentially inventing the technique of this test. And he said very specifically, you cannot use this test to either prove infectious etiology or to diagnose an infectious disease, which of course is interesting, because if you can't use it to diagnose an infectious disease, that of course begs the question of what can you use it for? But let me back up here and describe what a surrogate test means, because this is very important to understanding the situation we're currently in. A surrogate test means that in a situation where you're trying to prove causation, you have to have a gold standard test. And those postulates, like with meningococcus, that is a gold standard test. It's reliable 100% of the time. You cannot use a surrogate test to prove anything. And that is what is happening with these tests. So what is the surrogate test? So remember that we don't have a gold standard. We don't have isolation, purification, reinfection. We don't have viremia. We don't have millions of copies demonstrated on an electron microscope. We essentially have no idea who has this coronavirus disease. So then they take a piece of one of the coronaviruses, the new one that they found. It has a new RNA sequence that hasn't been found before. They take one of the sequences, which they say is unique to that particular virus, and they do something called amplify it. And what that means is, you take in your blood, you'll have one copy of this sequence, and it's too small, you can't find it. So you stimulate it, and this is what Kerry Mullis came up with. You stimulate it, it makes two copies, that's one cycle. You make four copies, that's two. You make 2 to the 20th copies, whatever number that is, that's 20 cycles. And what you find with this test is that once you put it through approximately 36 cycles, then you start to see the color change that tells you it's positive. So if you do 35 cycles, it's still too small to see. If you do 36, you start to see it, but you get false negatives, even though you don't really know which is a false negative because you don't have anything to compare it with. So then you do 37 and you see it, you know, 5% of the time of people with these symptoms. and you say, that's the number. But here's where it gets interesting. If you do it 40 times, you start seeing a lot more positives. And then here's something else to know. If you do it 60 times, so if you amplify it over and over and over again, it becomes positive with 100% of the people. Let me say that again. If you amplify it 60 times, it will be positive with everybody. That means that everybody has a piece of this RNA somewhere in their cells or in their genome or somewhere in their secretions, all you have to do is amplify it enough. And the problem is we don't know how many false positives or false negatives there are because we have nothing to compare it to. And if all biological tests have false positives, so if you test 30 million people and you have a 1% false positive rate, then 300,000 people by definition will test positive, and then you have an epidemic. And then if you want to demonstrate that the epidemic got better, all you have to do is lower the amplification cycles to 35, and then suddenly your vitamin C or your vaccine or your chloroquine or whatever you did worked, and now there's no more people testing positive. That is fraught with problems, and that is the problem. And unfortunately, with every country has their own standard of what kind of cycles they put it through, the number. So you see very different numbers coming out of very different places, depending on the number of amplification cycles that they're standardizing their test to. And I hope everybody is getting the point that this is a crazy situation.
That was Dr. Tom Cowan, another doctor, pointing out the inaccuracy of the PCR test with unassailable data. If you're walking around with a face mask outside because you think it's mandatory, it isn't. You don't have to wear it outside. I want to reiterate from 2 weeks ago what the German neurophysiologist said about starving the hippocampus of oxygen and what would happen later on in your life. Dr. Marguerite Gries-Bresson, a PhD, a consultant neurologist and neurophysiologist with a PhD in pharmacology and special interest in neurotoxicology, environmental medicine, neuroregeneration, and neuroplasticity. She said the re-inhalation of our exhaled air will without a doubt create oxygen deficiency and a flooding of carbon dioxide. We know that the human brain is very sensitive to oxygen deprivation. There are nerve cells, for example, in the hippocampus that can't be without oxygen longer than 3 minutes. They cannot survive. The acute warning symptoms are headaches, drowsiness, dizziness, issues in concentration, slowing down of reaction time. These are reactions of the cognitive system. However, when you have chronic oxygen deprivation, all of those symptoms disappear because you get used to it. But your efficiency will remain impaired, and the undersupply of oxygen in your brain continues to progress. We know that neurodegenerative disease takes years to decades to develop. If today you forget your phone number, the breakdown in your brain would have already started 20 or 30 years ago. While you're thinking that you've gotten used to wearing your mask and rebreathing your own exhaled air, the degenerative processes in your brain are getting amplified as your oxygen deprivation continues. So she's telling you that this is long-term and permanent. You cannot starve the hippocampus part of your brain of oxygen longer than 3 minutes. If you do so, you are at risk for dementia later on in life. The second problem is that the nerve cells in your brain are unable to divide themselves normally. So in case our governments would let us get rid of the masks and go back to breathing oxygen freely again in a few months, the lost nerve cells will no longer be regenerated. What's gone is gone. I don't wear a mask. I need my brain to think, she writes. I want to have a clear head when I deal with my patients and not to be in a carbon dioxide-induced anesthesia. There is no unfounded medical exemption from face masks because oxygen deprivation is dangerous to every single brain. It must be the free decision of every human being whether they want to wear a mask that is absolutely ineffective to protect themselves from a virus. To deprive a child or an adolescent's brain from oxygen or to restrict it in any way is not only dangerous to their health, it's absolutely criminal. Oxygen deficiency inhibits the development of the brain, and the damage that has taken place as a result cannot, she writes, cannot be reversed. The child needs the brain to learn, and the brain needs oxygen to function. We don't need a clinical study for that. That is simple, indisputable physiology. Consciously and purposely induced oxygen deficiency is an absolute deliberate health hazard and an absolute medical contraindication. An absolute medical contraindication in medicine means that this drug, this therapy, this method, or measure shouldn't be used and is not allowed to be used to coerce an entire population to use an absolute medical contraindication by force. There must be definite and serious reasons for this, and the reasons must be presented to competent interdisciplinary and independent bodies to be verified and authorized. When in 10 years dementia is going to increase exponentially and the younger generations couldn't reach their God-given potential, it won't help to say we didn't need the masks. How can a veterinarian, a software distributor, a businessman, an electric car manufacturer, and physicist decide on matters regarding the health of an entire population? Please, dear colleagues, we all have to wake up. I know how damaging oxygen deprivation is for the brain. Cardiologists know how damaging it is for the heart. Pulmonologists know how damaging it is for the lungs. Oxygen deprivation damages every single organ. Where are our health departments, our health insurance, our medical associations? It would have been their duty to stand against the lockdown and to stop it and stop it from the very beginning. Why do the medical boards issue punishments to doctors who give people exemptions? Does the person or doctor seriously have to prove that oxygen deprivation harms people? What kind of medicine are our doctors and medical associations representing? Who is responsible for this crime? Who are the ones who want to enforce it? Who are the ones who let it happen and play along, or the ones who don't prevent it? It's not about masks. It's not about viruses. It's certainly not about your health. It is much, much more. I am not participating, and I'm not afraid. That was Dr. Marguerite Bresson, PhD, consultant neurologist and neurophysiologist with a PhD in pharmacology. She has a special interest in neurotoxicology, environmental medicine, neuroregeneration, and neuroplasticity. Here's an article in the Activist Post titled, Colorado County Refuses to Enforce Lockdowns as Civil Disobedience Spreads Across America, by John Miltimore. Colorado officials last week announced that several counties had moved into the, quote, red level, the second highest measurement on its COVID-19 dial, and would be forced to implement new regulations on restaurants, gyms, and other parts of the economy to combat the virus. Then something remarkable happened. Weld County, a county in the northern part of the state with a population of about 250,000 people, politely said no. Quote, instead, county government continues to do what it has done since March, which is promote and encourage residents and business owners to take individual responsibility and make decisions to protect themselves, their family, their community, and their businesses, end quote. That's the Board of Commissioners. With a test positivity rate north of 16%, Weld County's infection rate is well above the 5% threshold the World Health Organization uses as a benchmark for taking proactive measures to limit the spread of the virus. Nevertheless, county officials enumerated what they would not do. They will not enforce a rule confining individuals to their homes for an undetermined length of time. They will not enforce a rule that states residents cannot have personal gatherings. They will not tell the school districts how to provide education to their students. They will not enforce a rule requiring a reduction of attendees in places of worship. They will not enforce a rule demanding restaurants close their indoor dining areas. And they won't enforce any rule that forces a business to shut down or impedes their ability to operate. Weld County's defiance came just days before the news broke that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is furious because a Brooklyn synagogue reportedly held a secret wedding earlier this month with thousands of unmasked guests in attendance. If that happened, it was a blatant disregard of the law, Cuomo said in a briefing. It's illegal. It was also disrespectful to the people of New York. Reports say the synagogue, the Yitev Lev Temple in Williamsburg, was fined $15,000. There was also a very tense confrontation in Buffalo, New York, at a local gym when health inspectors and deputies arrived, apparently after receiving an anonymous complaint, and they refused to leave. And that video went all over the internet. The defiance against lockdowns has been a long time coming. The reality is enforcement of social distancing regulations has been arbitrary. We've watched again and again as politicians flaunted their own orders without penalty. We've seen social distancing exceptions made when a political cause was deemed important or simply worth celebrating. That was an article in Activist Post titled, Colorado County Refuses to Enforce Lockdowns as Civil Disobedience Spreads Across America. In this next audio segment, James Corbett from the Corbett Report says, this isn't about stopping COVID-19 or slowing down the spread. If you're an advocate for lockdowns, you're complicit in tearing families apart, the poorest and most vulnerable in our societies, into even further grinding poverty.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. In 2006, a 15-year-old high school student from Albuquerque, New Mexico, won third place in the Intel Science and Engineering Fair for her project on slowing the spread of an infectious pathogen during a pandemic emergency. Using a computer simulation that she developed with the help of her father, she argued that in order to slow the spread of the disease, governments should implement school shutdowns, keep kids at home, and enforce social distancing. Incredibly, that third place high school science fair project can be tied directly to the lockdown policies being implemented by governments around the world today. You see, that father that she developed her computer simulation with was no average doting dad, but a senior researcher at Sandia National Laboratories who, at that time, was working on pandemic emergency response plans for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. His proposal to implement school shutdowns and, if need be, workplace shutdowns in the event of a pandemic emergency was developed at least in part in response to his daughter's high school project. Now, those advocating for lockdowns have seen the destruction and death that those policies have wrought this year, and we are living through that right now. Not only are people being deprived of their livelihoods and forced into grinding poverty as a direct result of these shutdowns, but now the undeniable truth is that if you are advocating for lockdowns, you are advocating for some portion of the population to be consigned to death. This is no longer debatable. It is even openly admitted, although months too late, by the World Health Organization.
I want to say it again. We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as a primary means of control of this virus. We may well have a doubling of world poverty by next year. We may well have at least a doubling of child malnutrition because children are not getting meals at school and their parents in poor families are not able to afford it. This is a terrible, ghastly global catastrophe, actually. And so we really do appeal to all world leaders. Stop using lockdown as your primary control method. Develop better systems for doing it. Work together and learn from each other. But remember, lockdowns just have one consequence that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer.
This is the point at which, no doubt, I'll be expected to produce the data to back up the non-controversial observation that lockdowns kill, even though that data will do precisely nothing to penetrate the consciousness of those who have already decided that they occupy the moral high ground for advocating locking billions of people around the globe as prisoners inside their own homes. But persevere I will. I'll point, for example, to the letter signed by hundreds of doctors calling the lockdowns themselves a mass casualty incident and exhorting politicians to end the shutdowns. I'll point to the research that shows that thousands of people will die because of delays to cancer surgery treatments as a result of the medical shutdowns. I'll point to the research of the Well-Being Trust showing that 75,000 Americans are expected to die deaths of despair, including alcohol and drug misuse and suicide, this year alone as a result of the lockdowns. I will point to the research of The Lancet showing that 265 million people are expected to be thrown into severe food insecurity as a result of these lockdowns. I will even point to the research showing 125,000 children are expected to die from malnutrition as a result of these lockdowns. But as I say, none of these deaths will matter to those who have already decided that they are right and virtuous for advocating locking vast swaths of the human population inside their own homes to starve to death in the name of slowing the spread of a disease that even the epidemiologists who have been wrong about everything this year tell us will kill less than 1% of the infected. Yes, slowing the spread, not stopping the spread. This was never about stopping a pandemic. Even the lockdown advocates never advocated that, but somehow that has been forgotten, and 15 days to flatten the curve has turned into a never-ending carte blanche for the biosecurity state to implement any number of draconian policies on its population, any number of policies on the checklist of the would-be dictator, not only locking people inside their own homes, but constant surveillance of the population through the contact tracing and tracking apps that are increasingly being implemented around the globe, and inevitably the proposals for mandating the experimental vaccines, which agents of the state will forcibly inject into people against their will. This is not acceptable. We cannot allow this to stand. If we forsake this, our most basic right, the right to step foot outside of our own homes, then we forsake our humanity itself. An important part of what makes us human is being taken away from us in the name of stopping the spread of COVID-19. But there is good news for those who have managed to retain their sanity in the time of insanity. We do not need a complicated plan in order to subvert this agenda. We do not need special deputization or to ask permission from the government. We do not need to join any particular political party or even any particular protest movement. All we have to do is disobey these unlawful orders.
The persistent anti-lockdown protesters said they will not forget Melbourne's strict 112-day measures as they took to the steps of Parliament. They carried signs saying don't trust the government and chanted for police to join them in their rally.
I've lost friends, I've lost family who've killed themselves. I've seen clients die because they've lost their livelihood.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know you are, and I'm asking for you to guys have some compassion.
Can you arrest us all? Because from what I'm gathering here in this area, we are all banding together and going against our governor.
If you have managed to retain your sanity during this time of widespread insanity, I applaud you and wish to assure you that you are not alone. Many, many people all around the world are defying orders. They are protesting against these lockdowns. They are standing up. They are disobeying. But of course, the corporate-controlled press don't want you to know that disobedience is an option on the table, and they will not report on this. But disobedience is an option. open your business, leave your home, do not ask for permission, disobey. To those who are still advocating for lockdowns, I encourage you to do so to the face of those parents who have lost their teenage children due to suicide as a direct result of the shutdowns, and tell them that their child's death doesn't matter because it wasn't listed as being due to COVID-19. Or do so to the face of the tens of thousands of others who have already lost loved ones as a direct result of these shutdowns, or the hundreds of thousands more who will die as long as these lockdowns endure. If you are advocating for lockdowns, you are complicit in tearing families apart. You are complicit in inflicting untold suffering on millions of people around the world. You are complicit in casting the poorest and most vulnerable in our societies into even further grinding poverty. You are complicit in murder. A line is being crossed right now. Which side of history are you on? Make your decision now and make it wisely, because your actions during these times will not be forgotten. You have been warned. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
That was James Corbett essentially stating that the only way out at this point is civil disobedience. As we've heard in the past few weeks, there's a growing sentiment of resistance against the recent wave of shutdowns. Back to the news of gathering evidence of voter fraud and manipulation, we hear a short speech from Pennsylvania Senator Doug Mastriano at the Voter Fraud Evidence Committee last week in Gettysburg. Let's have a listen.
And Mr. Mayor, it's going to be a fantastic hearing today. Despite pleas from our citizens, the governor refuses to even consider that there is any shenanigans in the elections here in our state, a state of 13 million people, and he wants a discount because his guy won, that nothing bad happened, and that's just unacceptable. If there's any hint of fraud out there, we need to investigate. Any governor serving the people, this Commonwealth, would put aside his petty politics, and find out the truth if anyone was defrauded. And at this point here, he's unwilling to do that. Let me point out some hard facts here. We are in Adams County, named after our second president, John Adams, who famously said, "Facts are stubborn things." Let me lay out several of these inconvenient truths, as Al Gore would have us think. There have been many allegations of voting law violations across the state, and a governor serving the people would have to move heaven and earth to ensure no one was defrauded, but yet he's not moved to action. And even his Secretary of State, of course, says that there was no shenanigans of great concern. And I will remind everyone that I was a no vote on the confirmation of Kathleen Bookvar four times that I interacted with her. I asked her, why are elections in Afghanistan more secure than in Pennsylvania? And she sat there and blinked and couldn't give me a straight answer. That elections are more safe and secure in a war-torn country, devastated by conflict since 1979. What is going on here? The place where this all started in 1776, and we can't get an election right? You got to be kidding me here. And so as a result of her inaction, the governor's inaction, refusal to even look into any of the allegations, and to discount the very essential freedoms of our citizens, we are here today to try to find out what the heck happened in the election. You know, and likewise, our attorney general, our senior law enforcement official here, you know, instead of being focused on making sure things are lined up in kosher, before one vote was counted in Pennsylvania, the day before the election, declared Biden the winner. I mean, there's nothing to see here. Could you imagine if the shoe was on the other foot? Would the media be so gracious and merciful and kind if it was a Republican? Absolutely not. And so, Houston, we have a problem here. You know, one of the most troubling things in this whole endeavor here, and it's not just because of the COVID, it's just a lack of transparency and accountability. So we're here to start shedding light on the darkness. And then, of course, we have a Supreme Court that rewrote election law. You know, Act 77 has been painted out as a villain. Okay, we could debate that. But the real problem was is when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided they're going to write legislation and rewrite our law. And because of that, obviously, Pennsylvania, we got a lot of problems there. And that opened the door to all the shenanigans and abuses and folly that we're dealing with here in the state this day. So what's going on here? Thousands of people from across the Commonwealth have reached out to us, tens of thousands, asking and demanding action. They deserve it. And as a result of the inability of our executive branch to do their job, we're stepping in here. We're co-equal members, and we're going to do our job. We're looking for transparency and truth. There's going to be no grandstanding here. We're after facts. And we're going to have a good layout here of what happened. And you're going to have to decide, good people of Pennsylvania, on what happened and whether there's a strong case we made or not. You know, the forgotten men and women of our great state feel betrayed by their government. And I'm with them. I feel the betrayal as well. So we undertake these proceedings today to find out what happened. And then hopefully come up with an approach where it never happens again. And the issues are galore. You're going to hear about poll watchers being denied access, where election software vendors refuse to testify before the General Assembly. What do they got to hide? Do we expect the people to trust their government? And we got to earn their trust. And this is no game. And the very republic very much is at stake. Anyone who loves this country has to put aside their petty partisan politics and allow the light to shine where it is. And we're going to find the truth and celebrate it. You know, as a soldier and now as an elected member of the state Senate, I'm not going to stand aside. And neither of the members around me are as well. We're going to fight the good fight for freedom and secure our republic. Too many good men and women have gone before us who are giving their lives here. And to cast it aside now for power play is unacceptable and it's not going to happen. Thank you. We do our great men and women in uniform and those who lay down their lives and gave the last full measure of devotion a great disservice if we stand aside and allow bureaucrats and corrupt politicians to steal their voice and maybe even steal an election. We'll find out. John 8:36 says that if Jesus set you free indeed. We're going to walk as free people in Pennsylvania. This is where all started. We choose this day to walk as free men and women in honor of the sacrifice not only of Jesus on Calvary, but also in honor of the sacrifice of brave men and women in uniform who fought for and secured our freedoms. We will be relentless in our pursuit of the transparency, of accountability, and truth. The time for dithering, politics, and games is over. The time for truth and justice is now. In conclusion, as Benjamin Franklin was leaving Constitutional Hall in 1787, he was approached by Mrs. Powell, and Mrs. Powell ran up to him. We surmise she knew him personally, and she said, "Well, Mr. Franklin, what do we have, a monarchy or a republic?" And he said, "A republic if you can keep it. This is our time to keep this republic." Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you. Thanks, Senator Mastriano.
That was Pennsylvania Senator Mastriano at the voter fraud hearing, which is about 3 hours, and you can find that on YouTube right now. And YouTube includes, below the video, a message. It reads, "The AP, the Associated Press, has called the presidential race for Joe Biden. See more on Google." Well, lawyers and most politicians know that the media doesn't call or certify an election in the United States. We hear from former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani on his show, Common Sense, again clarifying what the evidence of voter fraud is and the cases going forward. Let's have a listen.
Hello, this is Rudy Giuliani, and I'm back with you with Rudy's Common Sense. Today, we are going to take a look at the myriad of cases that have been filed, because I know that that in and of itself has created some confusion. And it's led to some people saying there isn't a consistent legal theory, other people saying that facts haven't been proven, or things that have been alleged haven't been established with evidence. And I want to take you through that now, because everything that's happened has happened for a purpose, and everything that's happened has happened in a very, very determined way, and it's leading to a conclusion that is going to be very powerful and, we believe, very effective. And these steps are necessary because of the kind of crimes we're dealing with here and because of the multitude of jurisdictions that they happened in. It isn't like Bush v. Gore that happened in one place in one state. So this voter fraud, as we developed it and investigated, happened in many states. Some very provable, some will never be able to prove. In some, the voter fraud didn't matter because it didn't affect the result. So when you come down to it, it really turns out to be, in essence, I'd say six key states, and possibly eight. Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, Georgia, and Arizona. In those states, there's substantial evidence of different kinds of voter fraud, which, once proven, would constitute a vote way more than the margin of victory for Joe Biden, which is the reason the president, who is aware of all this, and almost all of it is in lawsuits, says that he believes he won the election. Now, where is this evidence? Well, most of it is in the public record, believe it or not. And you say, well, why don't you know it? You don't know it because the press doesn't cover it. You don't know it because we haven't had an opportunity yet to have a hearing. The Democrats carried out this conspiracy to defraud the American people through a crooked election in very carefully selected places. They didn't go to neutral territory. They didn't go to places where there's an equal number of Republicans or Democrats. They went to very, very heavily controlled Democrat cities in swing states where they control the political machinery, the judicial machinery, to some extent the law enforcement machinery, and are in control of the press, which is enamored of them and has kept them in office in some cases for 50 years or 60 years or some number like that, so that they can expect favorable treatment in the newspapers and even more favorable treatment in the courts. Here's an outline of the evidence so that you can see it's there and where to go find it, and that the statements that this is wild charges without evidence, and this is a unfortunately a piece of propaganda that even some of the mainstream media has picked up on, obviously, and even some of the more conservative reporters have picked up on it, partially because they're not doing the hard work of reading the complaints. We try to read it to them, but they don't seem to pay attention. When we held a press conference, I deliberately read from several of the affidavits so that they would realize this is not our words, it's theirs. But the propaganda spin is powerful. So let's see if we can cut through that. The first case, or not necessarily the first, but the first I'll mention is Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a case that involves, I guess, on the big picture, the election officials in Pennsylvania running an illegal election in defiance of the state legislature. Now, first, you should understand, both for the factual recitation and the legal theory, that elections for president are run by state legislature. Now, that sounds strange, but that's the way it is. In Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, it reads as follows. Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. All right. In such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. A number of electors equal the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Constitution. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the Constitution may participate, et cetera, et cetera. So in distinction with the what we call the Elector's Clause, the Election Clause, rather. The Elector's Clause rests in the discretion of the state legislature. So let's take a look at the Election Clause. The Election Clause says, the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations. So these federal regulations, these federal elections, although they're federal in nature, are directed by the state legislature. So let's go back to the Elector's Clause because that governs a federal election. The legislature sets the rules. The election commissions have to follow the rules. The election commissions have no discretion. They have no right to change the rules. Can they make small decisions about timing or number of machines in a particular voting place? Or sure. But can they make big decisions like how to count the vote or what security is necessary? No, they have to follow the letter of the law from the state precisely. And that becomes both a violation of state law and a violation of the Constitution, because remember, it says in the Constitution that the legislature shall determine the rules and the conduct of both elections for Congress and particularly for the presidency. So in Pennsylvania, the rule is that when you have an absentee ballot, both sides must be present in order to inspect that ballot. In the case of Pennsylvania, in two places, and largely only in two places, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, 682,770 ballots were entered secretly, without examination, certainly by a Republican, and possibly even by a Democrat. That violates both the law of the state of Pennsylvania, and it violates the Constitution of the United States. Now, there's a wrinkle on this because the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania has rendered the irrational decision, irrational driven by the fact that it's 5-2 Democrat, and they had to find some way to not let Trump win this case. They decided that present doesn't mean that you have to get to see the ballot. Present means that you only have to be present in the room, which of course is absurd, and laws aren't passed have no meaning. What is the purpose of having somebody in the room while a ballot is counted and you can't see it when you're supposed to be there to assure that the ballot isn't fraudulent? There's no purpose to that. The better interpretation, which was the interpretation of the lower court, and I think anyone who understands English, present means present with the ability to observe so that you can determine if it's a valid ballot or not. And then, of course, it all raises the question, if you do that, if you do exclude Republicans en masse for 682,770 ballots, why are you doing it? Obviously, if the ballots were pristine and there was nothing wrong with them, you'd let the Republicans look, because why have this issue? Why allow this issue to be raised? And when you know Philadelphia, of course, it would be surprising if they weren't cheating. So this was done so that not just the usual cheating could go on, but this could be mass cheating. Mass infusion of absentee ballots to make up for the extraordinary lead that Donald Trump had when the polls closed and the counting stopped on the evening of the 3rd and going into the morning of the 4th. He had an 800,000 lead with 64% of the vote to go, almost impossible to catch up unless you stuff the ballot box, which is exactly what they did. They're also in Pennsylvania, in violation of the rules of the legislature, people were allowed to cure their ballots. If they put in an early ballot and they left off their name, or they got their address wrong, or they failed to give their address, or they put a wrong name down, they were allowed in the Democrat part of the states to go get it back, but in the Trump parts of the state, they were not. Again, that's no there's no rule in Pennsylvania that allows anyone to cure a ballot. That's made up by an elector who had no right to make it up, is not the constitutional authority to do that, and secondly, did it in a way to discriminate against Republican voters. So there are many other irregularities in Boston, including physical violence used against some of the inspectors, people assisting other people in voting, ballot harvesting. All of it leads to the result that when you deduct the illegal votes from the legal votes, Trump leads by a very, very substantial margin, probably 300,000 votes. And we will be arguing that both in the lawsuit of Pennsylvania and then in the overarching lawsuit that we bring, which will also bring some clarity to this. We will argue that this was a violation of the Constitution because it varied very, very significantly from the rules set for the election, and that it varied to the detriment of one candidate, Donald Trump. So that case has been filed. Those facts have been out. Hard to say that isn't supported by evidence. Affidavits have been supplied. It's just laziness that has people just repeating that as a matter of propaganda. Then we move on to Michigan. Michigan, similar to Pennsylvania, excluded Republicans from viewing the absentee ballots, even though Michigan law required it, both the absentee and the mail-in ballots. The number not observed is in the hundreds of thousands. It more than overcomes the margin of victory. There was a more dramatic incident in Michigan, which is testified to by three witnesses, all in the affidavits, never read by the press, never discussed by the press, in order to give the impression that the case has no evidence. Well, here's the evidence. Three witnesses at 4:30 in the morning saw 100,000 ballots come in the back door. They came in garbage cans, and they came in cardboard boxes, and they came in shopping bags. They didn't appear to be official ballots. They were put on a table. The lowest number estimated is 60,000. The largest number is 100,000. And they were counted very, very rapidly without even looking at the name on the ballot. And then sometimes they were double, triple, and quadruple counted, meaning they were put in the machine one time, two times, three times, four times, five times. And then they were dumped into a pile. And this is very, very similar to activity that occurred in other places at approximately the same time. It was done because a halt had been called to the counting because Trump was getting too far ahead and the catch-up ballots had to be put in. Of course, once again, this is an election being carried out in violation of state law, in violation of the Constitution, because state law determines the constitutional rules here, the legislature does. Inspection is necessary. And also in Michigan, we have a key witness, a Democratic employee of the city of Detroit for over 30 years, who testifies that she was given over to election duty in September. From the very beginning, she was taught how to cheat. She was told to cheat. She was told not to look at signatures, not to ask for driver's licenses, not to ask for any form of identification, not to inquire about citizenship. When a person wasn't registered, she was told to find someone to register that person to. She was told, in other words, to engage in every manner of cheating you can engage in order to maximize a Democratic vote in that part of the city, even to the extent of her colleagues going over to voting machines for that early voting and showing people how to vote Democrat. And for those who only voted for Biden, to try to get them to vote for the rest of the ticket. She herself did that on several occasions. And then when time came for her to go work on counting the ballots, she corroborates the testimony of many, many others that people were not able to see just about a single ballot, and they were all entered in secret in Michigan. In Wisconsin, there's a similar violation of law. The applications for the mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, many, many are missing. The law in Wisconsin, again, set by the legislature, very, very strict. It requires that there be an application for every absentee or mail-in ballot, and if there is none, the vote doesn't count. We are undergoing that inquiry right now, and we'll determine what the number is. We only have to overcome a 10,000 vote margin. I do believe that that's going to happen. And I know the press will be very surprised when it does. In Nevada, similarly, the election was carried out in violation of state laws and regulations because instead of counting by hand and examining signatures by hand, many, many ballots were put into a machine, the Agilis machine. The machine was set so low, it was set below the specifications of the manufacturer or the specifications of anyone doing any kind of counting. So the machine missed numerous, many, many mismatched signatures. And again, it was in violation of the law of the state. The rest of the state counted by hand. And it inured tremendously to the benefit of the Democrat because it was in that part of the state. In Georgia, an agreement was made, and the agreement, called a consent decree, I believe, or whatever it is, an agreement was made not to match signatures. Of course, there was no authority to do that. The legislature required the matching of signatures. They didn't do it. They didn't do it with regard to hundreds of thousands of signatures. There also were numerous instances of overvotes, numerous instances of people voting two and three times, numerous instances of people voting other people's names. All of that is part of the lawsuit, but all of it again shows that the electors carried out the election in violation of state law, state constitution, which means a violation of the federal constitution. And then finally, Arizona. Arizona has all the same characteristics as the others, again with a group of witnesses, but each one has several variations of their own. For example, the state of Arizona has an 11,000 vote overcount as of now. That means 11,000 more people voted than were registered. That vote has to be canceled out. The lead, the Biden lead there is only 10,000. And then there have been discovered so far 36,000 people who voted who didn't have citizenship, who I guess in another way you could call illegals. And of course, no matter what the Democrats think, citizens can't vote and their votes have to be canceled. So those are the cases that we have so far. Those are the facts that we have so far. So when you hear the statement that these are just wild claims, these are backed by evidence in court right now in 4 cases, Georgia to be filed shortly and Arizona to be filed shortly. And in my next episode, we will talk about how these cases are going to move forward on their own, because they have to, because before you can bring a bigger case, these cases have to be allowed to develop so you can do some discovery, which we are presently doing. In the next episode, we'll talk about how they all tie together in something that's very, very interesting, very fascinating, and is exactly what is needed to bring justice here, to get this vote to exactly the right count and to determine who won based on honest ballots. I think the answer to that you know, but we'll take you through the legal way in which you prove that. We've now laid out the facts. So when the person comes up to you and says there are no facts, tell them this is because they're illiterate and they don't read. And they don't read affidavits that are attached to lawsuits, and they're all right here online. You also can get them at rudyscommonsense.com. That's rudyscommonsense.com. And when you're doing that, you might as well subscribe. It's for free. So we'll be back very soon to take up exactly how this is put together now that we have these four files, six eventually lawsuits, which can be somewhat confusing because they're in different places. They have one common theme, failure to allow us to inspect, but then they have very many variations based on the fraud in that particular place. This one lawsuit will try to bring it together in a whole to make it easier for people to understand and make it easier for the court. Thank you very much.
That was former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani laying out the evidence of voter fraud and the cases going forward. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests. Thank you.